Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Alice Bryant, Dorothy Gundy, John Russell, Jill Robbins, and Bruce Albert. Later, Ana Mateo will bring us this week's health report. But first, Somalis have been burying people killed in a huge explosion Saturday in the capital, Mogadishu. The Associated Press reported on Monday that the head of an emergency medical service said over 300 people were killed in the explosion. The Somali government said the number of dead is expected to rise in what has become one of the world's worst attacks in years. Some families may never recover their loved ones because many of the bodies were burned beyond recognition. There is no tragedy worse than when someone comes to the dead body of their relative and cannot recognize them, said the mayor of Mogadishu, Tabit Abdi Mohammed. He said, the horror of the attack was unspeakable. Mogadishu's hospitals have been struggling to treat the badly burned victims. The Somali government says it has set up an emergency center to help reunite families. The government has called for 3 days of national mourning. It also has asked that flags be flown at half-mast as a sign of respect for the victims. There was no immediate claim of responsibility for the attack. Angry protesters, however, condemned al-Shabaab. The militant group has yet to comment publicly on the bombing. But the government and terrorism experts strongly believe the group was responsible. Whether they claim or not claim makes no difference. We know the act that has happened. It's al-Shabaab, said Abdi Hassan Hussein, a former intelligence officer. He added, the information we are getting so far shows this is the work of al-Shabaab. On Sunday, hundreds of Somalis denounced the group at a protest in Mogadishu's business center, where a truck carrying the bomb exploded. Some demonstrators wept when they saw the damage caused by the explosion. In a statement, the U.S. State Department condemned the attack in the strongest terms. It said, the United States will continue to stand with the Somali government, its people, and our international allies to combat terrorism and support their efforts to achieve peace, security, and prosperity. Miriam Abdullahi just finished Bonadir University, where she studied medicine. She left her voluntary work at Bonadir Hospital Saturday and was waiting for a bus when the bomb exploded. She died immediately. Her mother called her daughter's telephone number as soon as she heard about the explosion. She told VOA Somali, I called her number immediately, but someone else answered, and they said the owner of the phone died. Abdullahi's father flew from London on Saturday to attend his daughter's graduation from the university. He arrived in Mogadishu Sunday morning and attended her funeral instead. Also killed were 5 members of the same family who were operating a clothing business. Hundreds of people were wounded in the attack. One of them is VOA's reporter in Mogadishu, Abdulkadir Mohammed Abdullah. Abdullah suffered injuries to the neck and hand and burns throughout his body. But he was in good spirits when he spoke about his condition. He said, I'm injured in the lower neck. There is shrapnel inside. I have a second injury on the right hand. Maybe it's broken. And third, my body is burned, in particular on the torso. I have smaller injuries throughout the body and facial injuries. Abdulay has memories of the attack. He said, I remember leaving the building near Safari Hotel. I wanted to get into my car. As I stepped towards the car, the explosion went off. That is all I remember. The next thing I know is this morning when I woke up at 10 a.m. when I saw people standing around my bed.
Iraqi troops seized oil fields and the area around Kirkuk in response to last month's Kurdish vote for independence. Tensions have grown since the Kurds voted for independence from Iraq. The Iraqi central government in Baghdad, as well as Turkey, Iran, and the United States, rejected the vote. But midday Monday, Iraqi federal forces took several major oil fields north of Kirkuk, as well as the city's airport and an important military base, according to Iraqi commanders. Kurdish party headquarters inside Kirkuk were abandoned. In a statement, the United States Military Task Force in Iraq described the fighting outside Kirkuk as a misunderstanding. The U.S. has armed, trained, and supported both sides in the fight against the Islamic State group. After reports of clashes in and around the city, Kurdish forces, known as the Peshmerga, appeared to withdraw without much of a fight. Local police remained in place in Kirkuk. Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi called on civil servants to remain at their posts to serve the city. Still, thousands of people could be seen carrying their belongings and heading north to Iraq's autonomous Kurdish region. Kirkuk is home to about 1 million Arabs, Kurds, Turkmen, and Christians. The city has been at the center of a long-running dispute between the autonomous Kurdish government and the central government in Baghdad. Both are close allies of the U.S. The Iraqi government and the Kurds have long been divided over the sharing of oil money, as well as over disputed territories like Kirkuk. The city is controlled by Kurdish forces, but is outside of their self-ruled region. The Kurds took control of Kirkuk, a major oil-producing area, in 2014. At the time, Islamic State militants had advanced across northern Iraq and the country's armed forces collapsed. Iraq has since rebuilt its armed forces with U.S. aid. And they are driving out IS militants from most of the territory it once held. Shiite Arab militias, backed by Iran, are fighting alongside the Iraqi armed forces in Kirkuk. Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi has said the militias will remain outside the city, however. Al-Iraqiya, the Iraqi government TV network, reported that the prime minister ordered federal forces to impose security in the city in cooperation with the inhabitants and the Peshmerga. Since the September independence vote, the Iraqi government has been pushing Kurdish leaders to accept shared administration of the oil-rich area. I'm Alice Bryant.
The European Union is reportedly ready to welcome Alexander Lukashenko of Belarus to its Eastern Partnership meeting next month. It is the first time EU officials have permitted Lukashenko to attend the meeting. The EAP summit will open in Brussels on November 24th. EU sources say Belarus was invited to take part in the summit without restrictions, just like the five other EAP members: Armenia, Azerbaijan, Georgia, Moldova, and Ukraine. The sources spoke with Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. Both RFERL and Voice of America are part of the United States-financed Broadcasting Board of Governors. There were four earlier EAP summits. Before each of them, the EU said the president of Belarus was not welcome to attend. Alexander Lukashenko has ruled Belarus for 21 years. He has been called the last dictator of Europe. Lukashenko has been president since 1994. He won a fifth term in a 2015 election that Western observers say was neither free nor fair. The Belarus government was represented by its foreign minister at the last Eastern Partnership summit, which was held in Riga in 2015. The EU launched the partnership in 2009 to support economic integration and European values in six Eastern European and South Caucasus countries. The EU announced restrictive measures against Belarus in 2004 after two opposition politicians disappeared. In 2010, the European Council took steps to punish Belarus after unrest following their earlier presidential election. But in February 2016, the EU lifted most of the restrictions against the country. The organization said it had canceled the sanctions in response to the release of all Belarusian political prisoners on August 22nd, 2016, and in the context of improving EU-Belarus relations. I'm Dorothy Gundy.
private car services that work only with women are becoming more popular in Brazil due to concerns about safety. One of the car services has a mobile app called Femitaxi. It has more than 1,000 drivers, giving some 20,000 rides per month. Femitaxi has expanded into 6 Brazilian cities and may go to other Latin American markets. A competing app, Lady Driver, launched in São Paulo in March. It has some 8,000 drivers and over 100,000 users. It plans to expand operations to Rio de Janeiro this month. The rapid growth of these apps in cities such as São Paulo highlights the rising concerns about public safety in Brazil. From August 2016 to August 2017, reports of crimes such as attempted rape rose by more than 10% in São Paulo state. Well-known transportation companies such as Uber, along with Spain's Cabify and 99, have also increased efforts to improve safety for drivers and passengers in Brazil this past year. High-profile cases of sexual assault on public buses have drawn attention to the issue of violence against women. Metros in the cities of Belo Horizonte and Recife have recently started female-only train cars. There have been female-only cars in Rio de Janeiro's trains for over a decade. Gabriela Correa is the founder and CEO of Lady Driver. "I think the problem of sexual harassment in public transport always existed, but it wasn't discussed," she said. "Now women are standing up, taking initiatives like our own to seek safety." Ride-hailing apps for female drivers and passengers are not unique to Brazil. See Jane Go, an all-women transportation app, launched in the American state of California in 2016. A rival company, Safer, launched in the American city of Boston earlier this year. I'm John Russell.
New York City is known for its tall buildings, financial markets, and centers for the arts. But America's most populated city is becoming known for something you might not expect: farms. New York City's government announced last month that it is providing $500,000 to create 2 urban farms. Both will use space in New York public housing developments. The new farms will join 4 other farms already operating with city government help. The idea is to get more fresh fruits and vegetables to communities in the city. City officials see it as a public health issue. These new urban farms will not only provide access to healthy produce, but also provide jobs to young residents, said New York City Councilman Richie Torres. The new farms will be in the New York City boroughs of Staten Island and the Bronx.
"These farms are supported by the local government, but there are also privately run farms in the city. In the New York City neighborhood of Tribeca, Robert Lang has opened up a privately run indoor farm called Farm One. he grows many kinds of herbs. His customers include well-known restaurants in New York City. The restaurants can pick up fresh herbs hours before they are needed for that night's dinner, because his farm can be reached by bicycle from much of the city. Lang's website tells customers that they can buy fresh herbs even in a snowstorm. Farm One is very different than farms in less populated communities. The major difference is size. It is only 112 meters. The U.S. Department of Agriculture says the average farm in America is 176 hectares. Farm One's crops are grown on vertical shelves, so more can be grown in less space. The nice thing about farming vertically indoors is that you don't need a lot of space, Lang said. I can see some bodega setting one up on the roof. Urban farms are growing in other cities besides New York City. The website inhabitat.com recently released a list of the top four U.S. cities for urban farms. They are Austin, Texas, Boston, Massachusetts, Cleveland, Ohio, and Detroit, Michigan.
The Johns Hopkins Center for a Livable Future released a report on urban farms in 2016. It said there are important benefits to turning unused land into sources of healthy food. But it said that urban farming still has a long way to go to produce the environmental and health benefits claimed by supporters. In some cases, the enthusiasm is ahead of the evidence, the Johns Hopkins research said. For example, the report said that supporters of growing food close to the people who eat it claim that it reduces pollution compared to transporting food long distances. But the researchers found that smaller farms do not do as good a job as larger farms in reducing use of water and other natural resources.
The Foundation for Food and Agriculture Research, based in Washington, D.C., wants more urban farms. It said the benefits are almost unlimited. The group announced last month that it will give $2 million to help pay for a new farm in Newark, New Jersey, just outside of New York City. Hero Farms will work with scientists from Cornell University in New York State and Rutgers University in New Jersey. The goal is to grow salad greens with improved taste and color. The funding announcement said that because the farm is indoors, the farmers can control the environment, including temperature, to improve their crops.
Sally Rocky is executive director of the Foundation for Food and Agriculture. She said that more than half the world's population lives in cities, and that it is important to provide healthy food to this population. Whenever possible, Rocky said, food should be grown locally. Brian Massey writes and farms. He recently wrote about managing an urban farm in a Washington, D.C. neighborhood near Howard University. His report appeared on the website civileats.com. He said that a lot of people liked the fresh fruit and vegetables his farm produced. But he said others worried the farm was there to help the newly arrived, wealthier residents, not the poor. There was a concern that the farm would add to Washington's continuing shortage of low-income housing, Massey wrote. I'm Jill Robbins.
And I'm Bruce Alpert.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. Each year, nearly 3 out of 4 children around the world experience some kind of violence. A new report confirms that finding, and another troubling development. Childhood violence is linked with violence against women. Children who see their mother being abused are more likely to be abused as an adult or become abusers themselves. The report is called Ending Violence in Childhood, Global Report 2017. The study was prepared for a children's rights group called No Violence in Childhood. The organization was launched in India 3 years ago. The study found that childhood violence happens nearly everywhere, in rich and poor countries alike. It affects an estimated 1.7 billion children every year. This violence includes fighting or bullying, the mistreatment or abuse of someone by a stronger or more powerful individual. It can also include sexual abuse, sexual violence, and physical punishment, both at home and in school. The researchers did not include violence from war and other events. Ramya Subramanian is executive director of No Violence in Childhood. She said that children experience emotional and physical punishment at young ages, some from as early as 2 years of age. She adds that violence is a learned behavior that comes from deep, long-held cultural values. For example, in some societies, beating is a form of discipline. The researchers say there is also an economic cost to society when children experience violence. They found that children who experience violence at home are more likely to miss school or even leave school and never return. They are less likely to get an education and succeed in life. No Violence in Childhood reports that up to 8% of the world's gross domestic product is spent on repairing the damage caused by childhood violence. GDP is usually defined as the total value of all goods and services. The report notes that even with such a high cost, governments fail to invest in policies that could stop the causes of childhood violence. The group's website explores ways to end the violence. It reports that experts say the first step is to speak out about violence against children. Keeping silent only increases the chance that violence will continue. The experts also say that it is important to educate caregivers and empower children to be strong and resilient. The report says that anti-violence education needs to be included in school systems, community programs, and in health services. And that's the Health and Lifestyle Report. I'm Ana Mateo.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.